round and spoke to her. "Now, I don't like telling you what I wanted, because you've fretting enough to go through, and I know you'll fret about this. I meant to have kept it from you till night, maybe, or such times as that."
"What is the matter? Pray tell me, Dixon, at once."
"That young woman you go to see, Higgins, I mean."
"Well?"
"Well, she died this morning, and her sister is here, come to beg a strange thing. It seems the young woman who died had a fancy for being buried in something of yours, and so the sister's come to ask for it, and I was looking for a nightcap that wasn't too good to give away."
"Oh, let me find one," said Margaret in the midst of her tears. "Poor Bessie, I never thought I should not see her again."
"Why, that's another thing. This girl downstairs wanted me to ask you if you would like to see her."
"But she's dead," said Margaret, turning a little pale. "I never saw a dead person. No, I would rather not."
"I should never have asked you. If you hadn't come in, I told her you wouldn't."
"I will go down and speak to her," said Margaret, afraid lest Dixon's harshness of manner might wound the poor girl. So, taking the cap in her hand, she went to the kitchen. Mary's face was all swollen with crying, and she burst out afresh when she saw Margaret.
"Oh, ma'am, she loved you. She loved you. She did indeed."
And for a long time Margaret could not get her to say anything more than this. At last her sympathy and Dixon's scolding forced out a few facts. Nicholas Higgins had gone out in the morning, leaving Bessie as well as on the day before. But in an hour she was taken worse. Some neighbour ran to the room where Mary was working. They did not know where to find her father. Mary had only come in a few minutes before she died. "It were a day or two ago she asked to be buried in somewhat o' yourn. She were never tired o' talking o' you. She used to say you were the prettiest thing she ever clapped eyes on. She loved you dearly. Her last words were, 'Give her my affectionate respect and keep father for a drink.' You'll come and see her, ma'am. She would have thought it a great compliment, I know."
Margaret shrank a little from answering.
"Yes, perhaps I may. Yes, I will. I'll come before tea. But where's your father, Mary?"
Mary shook her head and stood up to be going. "Miss Hale," said Dixon in a low voice, "where's the use of your going to see the poor thing laid out? I'd never say a word against it if it could do the girl any good, and I wouldn't mind a bit going myself, if that would satisfy her. They've just a notion, these common folks, of it being a respect to the departed." "Here," said she, turning sharply round, "I'll come and see your sister. Miss Hale is busy, and she can't come, or else she would." The girl looked wistfully at Margaret. Dixon's coming might be a compliment, but it was not the same thing to the poor sister, who had had her little pangs of jealousy during Bessie's lifetime at the intimacy between her and the young lady.
"No, Dixon," said Margaret with decision, "I will go. Mary, you shall see me this afternoon." And for fear of her own cowardice, she went away in order to take from herself any chance of changing her determination. Chapter 28. Comfort in Sorrow.
Through cross to crown, and though thy spirit's life trials untold assail with giant strength, good cheer, good cheer, soon ends the bitter strife, and thou shalt reign in peace with Christ at length.
Kosegarten.
I sooth we feel too strong in weal to need thee on that road, but woe being come, the soul is dumb that crieth not on God.
Mrs. Browning. That afternoon she walked swiftly to the Higgins house. Mary was looking out for her with a half-distrustful face. Margaret smiled into her eyes to reassure her. They passed quickly through the house place, upstairs, and into the quiet presence of the dead. Then Margaret was glad that she had come. The face, often so weary with pain, so restless with troublous thoughts, had now the faint soft smile of eternal rest upon it. The slow tears gathered into Margaret's eyes, but a deep calm entered into her soul. And that was death. It looked more peaceful than life. All beautiful scriptures came into her mind. "They rest from their labours. The weary are at rest.
he giveth his beloved sleep. Slowly, slowly Margaret turned away from the bed. Mary was humbly sobbing in the background. They went downstairs without a word. Resting his hand upon the house table, Nicholas Higgins stood in the midst of the floor, his great eyes startled open by the news he had heard as he came along the court from many busy tongues. His eyes were dry and fierce, studying the reality of her death, bringing himself to understand that her place should know her no more, for she had been sickly, dying so long that he had persuaded himself she would not die, that she would pull through. Margaret felt as if she had no business to be there, familiarly acquainting herself with the surroundings of death which he, the father, had only just learnt. There had been a pause of an instant on the steep, crooked stair when she first saw him, but now she tried to steal past his abstracted gaze and to leave him in the solemn circle of his household misery. Mary sat down on the first chair she came to, and throwing her apron over her head, began to cry. The noise appeared to rouse him. He took sudden hold of Margaret's arm and held her till he could gather words to speak, seemed dry. They came up thick and choked and hoarse.
"Were you with her? Did you see her die?"
"No," replied Margaret, standing still with the utmost patience, now she found herself perceived. It was some time before he spoke again, but he kept his hold on her arm. "All men must die," said he at last, with a strange sort of gravity, which first suggested to Margaret the idea that he had been drinking, not enough to intoxicate himself, but enough to make his thoughts bewildered.
"But she were younger than me."
Still he pondered over the event, not looking at Margaret, though he grasped her tight. Suddenly he looked up at her with a wild, searching inquiry in his glance.
"You're sure and certain she's dead? Not in a dwam, a faint? She's been so before, often."
"She is dead," replied Margaret. She felt no fear in speaking to him, though he hurt her arm with his gripe and wild gleams came across the stupidity of his eyes. "She is dead," she said. He looked at her still with that searching look which seemed to fade out of his eyes as he gazed. Then he suddenly let go his hold of Margaret, and throwing his body half across the table, he shook it and every piece of furniture in the room with his violent sobs. Mary came trembling towards him.
"Get thee gone! Get thee gone!" he cried, striking wildly and blindly at her. "What do I care for thee?"
Margaret took her hand and held it softly in hers. He tore his hair, he beat his head against the hard wood, then he lay exhausted and stupid. Still his daughter and Margaret did not move. Mary trembled from head to foot. At last, it might have been a quarter of an hour, it might have been an hour, he lifted himself up. His eyes were swollen and bloodshot, and he seemed to have forgotten that anyone was by. He scowled at the watches when he saw them. He shook himself heavily, gave them one more sullen look, spoke never a word, but made for the door.
"Oh, father, father," said Mary, throwing herself upon his arm. "Not tonight, any night but tonight. Oh, help me, he's going out to drink again. Father, I'll not leave you. You may strike, but I'll not leave you. She told me last of all to keep you for a drink."
But Margaret stood in the doorway, silent yet commanding. He looked up at her defyingly.
"It's my own house. Stand out of the way, wench, or I'll make you."
He had shaken off Mary with violence. He looked ready to strike Margaret, but she never moved a feature, never took her deep, serious eyes off him. He stared back on her with gloomy fierceness. If she had stirred hand or foot, he would have thrust her aside with even more violence than he had used to his own daughter, whose face was bleeding from her fall against a chair.
"What are you looking at me in that way for?" asked he at last, daunted and awed by her severe calm. "If you think but to keep me from going what gate I choose because she loved you, and in my own house too, where I never asked you to come, you're mistaken. It's very hard upon a man when he can't go to the only comfort left."
Margaret felt that he acknowledged her power. What could she do next? He had seated himself on a chair close to the door, half conquered, half resenting,
intending to go out as soon as she left her position, but unwilling to use the violence he had threatened not 5 minutes before. Margaret laid her hand on his arm. "Come with me," she said. "Come and see her." The voice in which he spoke was very low and solemn, but there was no fear or doubt expressed in it, either of him or of his compliance. He sullenly rose up. He stood uncertain, with dogged irresolution upon his face. She waited him there, quietly and patiently waited for his time to move. He had a strange pleasure in making her wait, but at last he moved towards the stairs. She and he stood by the corpse. Her last words to Mary were, "Keep my father for a drink." "It canna hurt her now," muttered he. "Nought can hurt her now." Then raising his voice to a wailing cry, he went on, "We may quarrel and fall out, we may make peace and be friends, we may clem to skin and bone, and nought or all our griefs will ever touch her more. Who's had her portion on him? What were hard work first and sickness at last, who's led the life of a dog, and to die without knowing one good piece of rejoicing in all her days? Nay, wench, whatever who said, who can know nought about it now, and I mun ha' a sup o' drink just to steady me again sorrow." "No," said Margaret, softening with his softened manner, "you shall not. If her life has been what you say, at any rate she did not fear death as some do. Oh, you should have heard her speak of the life to come, the life hidden with God that she is now gone to." He shook his head, glancing sideways up at Margaret as he did so. His pale, haggard face struck her painfully. "You are sorely tired. Where have you been all day? Not at work?"
"Not at work, sure enough," said he, with a short, grim laugh. "Not at what you call work. I were at the committee, till I was sickened out with trying to make fools hear reason. I were fetched to Boucher's wife before 7 this morning. She's bedfast, but she were raving and raging to know where her dunder-headed brute of a chap was, as if I'd to keep him, as if he were fit to be ruled by me. The damned fool, who has put his foot in all our plans, and I've walked my feet sore with going about for to see men who wouldn't be seen, now the law is raised against us. And I were sore-hearted too, which is worse than sore-footed, and if I did see a friend who ost to treat me, I never knew who lay a-dying here. Best lass, thou'd believe me, thou wouldst, wouldn'st thou?" turning to the poor dumb form with wild appeal.
"I am sure," said Margaret, "I am sure you did not know. It was quite sudden, but now you see it would be different. You do know, you do see her lying there, you hear what she said with her last breath. You will not go?"
No answer. In fact, where was he to look for comfort?
"Come home with me," said she at last, with a bold venture, half trembling at her own proposal as she made it. "At least you shall have some comfortable food, which I'm sure you need."
"Your father's a parson?" asked he, with a sudden turn in his ideas.
"He was," said Margaret shortly.
"I'll go and take a dish of tea with him, since you've asked me. I've many a thing I often wish to say to a parson, and I'm not particular as to whether he's preaching now or not."
Margaret was perplexed. His drinking tea with her father, who would be totally unprepared for his visitor, her mother so ill, seemed utterly out of the question. And yet if she drew back now, it would be worse than ever, sure to drive him to the gin shop. She thought that if she could only get him to their own house, it was so great a step gained that she would trust to the chapter of accidents for the next.
"Goodbye, old wench. We've parted company at last, we have. But thou'st been a blessing to thy father ever since thou wert born. Bless thy white lips, lass. They've a smile on em now, and I'm glad to see it once again, though I'm lone and forlorn forevermore."
He stooped down and fondly kissed his daughter, covered up her face, and turned to follow Margaret. She had hastily gone downstairs to tell Mary of the arrangement, to say it was the only way she could think of to keep him from the gin palace, to urge Mary to come too, for her heart smote her at the idea of leaving the poor affectionate girl alone. But Mary had friends among the neighbours, she said, who would come in and sit a bit with her. It was all right, but father... He was there by them as she would have spoken more. He had shaken off his emotion as if he was ashamed of having ever given way to it, and had even o'erleaped himself so much that he assumed a sort of bitter mirth, like the crackling of thorns under a pot.
"I'm going to take my tea where her father I am."
But he slouched his cap low down over his brow as he went out into the street, and looked neither to the right nor to the left while he tramped along by Margaret's side. He feared being upset by the words, still more the looks of sympathizing neighbors, so he and Margaret walked in silence. As he got near the street in which he knew she lived, he looked down at his clothes, his hands and shoes.
"I should mop and clean myself first."
It certainly would have been desirable, but Margaret assured him he should be allowed to go into the yard and have soap and towel provided. She could not let him slip out of her hands just then. While he followed the house servant along the passage and through the kitchen, stepping cautiously on every dark mark in the pattern of the oilcloth, in order to conceal his dirty footprints, Margaret ran upstairs. She met Dixon on the landing. "How is Mama? Where is Papa?" Missus was tired and gone into her own room. She had wanted to go to bed, but Dixon had persuaded her to lie down on the sofa and have her tea brought to her there. It would be better than getting restless by being too long in bed. So far, so good. But where was Mr. Hale? In the drawing room. Margaret went in half breathless with the hurried story she had to tell. Of course she told it incompletely, and her father was rather taken aback by the idea of the drunken weaver awaiting him in his quiet study, with whom he was expected to drink tea, and on whose behalf Margaret was anxiously pleading. The meek, kind-hearted Mr. Hale would have readily tried to console him in his grief, but, unluckily, the point Margaret dwelled upon most forcibly was the fact of his having been drinking, and her having brought him home with her as a last expedient to keep him from the gin shop. One little event had come out of another so naturally that Margaret was hardly conscious of what she had done, till she saw the slight look of repugnance on her father's face. "Oh, Papa, he really is a man you will not dislike, if you won't be shocked to begin with." "But, Margaret, to bring a drunken man home, and your mother so ill." Margaret's countenance fell. "I am sorry, Papa. He is very quiet. He is not tipsy at all. He was only rather strange at first, but that might be the shock of poor Bessie's death." Margaret's eyes filled with tears. Mr. Hale took hold of her sweet, pleading face in both his hands and kissed her forehead. "It is all right, dear. I'll go and make him as comfortable as I can, and do you attend to your mother. Only if you can, come in and make a third in the study. I shall be glad."
"Oh, yes, thank you."
But as Mr. Hale was leaving the room, she ran after him. "Papa, you must not wonder at what he says. He does not believe in much of what we do."
"Oh, dear, a drunken infidel weaver," said Mr. Hale to himself in dismay. But to Margaret he only said, "If your mother goes to sleep, be sure you come directly."
Margaret went into her mother's room. Mrs. Hale lifted herself up from a doze.
"When did you write to Frederick, Margaret? Yesterday or the day before?"
"Yesterday, Mama."
"Yesterday. And the letter went?"
"Yes, I took it myself."
"Oh, Margaret, I'm so afraid of his coming. If he should be recognized, if he should be taken, if he should be executed after all these years, but he has kept away and lived in safety. I keep falling asleep and dreaming that he is caught and being tried."
"Oh, Mama, don't be afraid. There will be some risk, no doubt, but we will lessen it as much as ever we can, and it is so little. Now, if we were at Helston, there would be 20, 100 times as much. There, everybody would remember him, and if there was a stranger known to be in the house, they would be sure to guess it was Frederick. While here, nobody knows or cares for us enough to notice what we do. Dixon will keep the door like a dragon, won't you, Dixon, while he is here?"
"They'll be clever if they come in past me," said Dixon, showing her teeth at the bare idea.
"And he need not go out, except in the dusk, poor fellow."
"Poor fellow," echoed Mrs. Hale. "But I almost wish you had not written. Would it be too late to stop him if you wrote again, Margaret?"
"I'm afraid it would, Mama," said Margaret, remembering the urgency with which she had entreated him to come directly if he wished to see his mother alive.
"I always dislike that doing things in such a hurry," said Mrs. Hale.
Margaret was silent.
"Come now, ma'am," said Dixon, with a kind of cheerful authority. "You know seeing Master Frederick is just the very thing of all others you're longing for. And I'm glad Miss Margaret wrote off straight, without shilly-shallying. I've had a great mind to do it myself, and we'll keep him snug, depend upon it. There's only Martha in the house that would not do a good deal to save him on a pinch, and I've been thinking she might go and see her mother just at that very time. She's been saying once or twice she should like to go, for her mother has had a stroke since she came here, only she didn't like to ask. But I'll see about her being safe off as soon as we know when he comes. God bless him. So take your tea, ma'am, in comfort, and trust to me."
Mrs. Hale did trust in Dixon more than in Margaret. Dixon's words quieted her for the time. Margaret poured out the tea in silence, trying to think of something agreeable to say, but her thoughts made answer something like Daniel O'Rourke when the man in the moon asked him to get off his reaping hook. "The more you ax us, the more we won't stir." The more she tried to think of something, anything, besides the danger to which Frederick would be exposed, the more closely her imagination clung to the unfortunate idea presented to her. Her mother prattled with Dixon and seemed to have utterly forgotten the possibility of Frederick being tried and executed, utterly forgotten that at her wish, if by Margaret's deed, he was summoned into this danger. Her mother was one of those who throw out terrible possibilities, miserable probabilities, unfortunate chances of all kinds, as a rocket throws out sparks. But if the sparks light on some combustible matter, they smoulder first and burst out into a frightful flame at last. Margaret was glad when her filial duties, gently and carefully performed, she could go down into the study. She wondered how her father and Higgins had got on. In the first place, the decorous, kind-hearted, simple, old-fashioned gentleman had unconsciously called out, by his own refinement and courteousness of manner, all the latent courtesy in the other. Mr. Hale treated all his fellow creatures alike. It never entered into his head to make any difference because of their rank. He placed a chair for Nicholas, stood up till he, at Mr. Hale's request, took a seat, and called him invariably Mr. Higgins, instead of the curt Nicholas, or Higgins, to which the drunken infidel weaver had been accustomed. But Nicholas was neither an habitual drunkard nor a thorough infidel. He drank to drown care, as he would have himself expressed it, and he was infidel so far as he had never yet found any form of faith to which he could attach himself, heart and soul. Margaret was a little surprised and very much pleased when she found her father and Higgins in earnest conversation, each speaking with gentle politeness to the other, however their opinions might clash. Nicholas, clean, tidied, if only at the pump trough, and quiet-spoken, was a new creature to her, who had only seen him in the rough independence of his own hearthstone. He had slicked his hair down with the fresh water. He had adjusted his neck handkerchief and borrowed an odd candle end to polish his clogs with, and there he sat, enforcing some opinion on her father, with a strong Darkshire accent, it is true, but with a lowered voice and a good earnest composure on his face. Her father, too, was interested in what his companion was saying. He looked round as she came in, smiled and quietly gave her his chair, and then sat down afresh as quickly as possible, and with a little bow of apology to his guest for the interruption. Higgins nodded to her as a sign of greeting, and she softly adjusted her working materials on the table and prepared to listen.
"As I was a-saying, sir, I reckon you'd not have much belief in you if you'd lived here, if you'd been bred here. I ax your pardon if I use long words, but what I mean by belief just now is a thinking on sayings and maxims and promises made by folk you never saw, about the things in the life you never saw, nor no one else. Now, you say these are true things, and true sayings, and a true life. I just say, where's the proof? There's many and many a one wiser, and scores better learned than I am around me, folk who've had time to think on these things, while my time has had to be gearing up to getting my bread. Well, I sees these people,
Their lives is pretty much open to me. They're real folk. They don't believe in the Bible. Not they. They may say they do, for form's sake. But, Lord, sir, do ye think their first cry in the morning is, "What shall I do to get hold on eternal life?" Or, "What shall I do to fill my purse this blessed day? Where shall I go? What bargains shall I strike?" The purse and the gold and the notes is real things, things as can be felt and touched. Them's realities, and eternal life is all a talk, very fit for. I ax your pardon, sir. You're a parson now to work, I believe. Well, I'll never speak disrespectful of a man in the same fix as I am in my cell. For I'll just ax you another question, sir, and I do not want you to answer it. Only to put in your pipe and smoke it afore you go for to set down us, who only believe in what we see, as fools and noddies. If salvation and life to come and what not was true, not in men's words but in men's hearts' core, don't you not think they'd din us wi' it, as they do wi' political economy? They're mighty anxious to come round us wi' that piece o' wisdom, but t'other would be a greater conversion if it were true. But the masters have nothing to do with your religion. All that they are connected with you in is trade, so they think, and all that it concerns them, therefore, to rectify your opinions in, is the science of trade. I'm glad, sir, said Higgins, with a curious wink of his eye, that you put in, so they think. I'd have thought you a hypocrite, I'm afeard, if you hadn't, for all you're a parson, or either because you're a parson. You see, if you'd spoken of religion as a thing that, if it were true, it didn't concern all men to press on all men's attention above everything else in this barsel earth, I should have thought you a knave for to be a parson. And I'd rather think you a fool than a knave. No offence, I hope, sir. None at all. You consider me mistaken, and I consider you far more fatally mistaken. I don't expect to convince you in a day, not in one conversation, but let us know each other, and speak freely to each other about these things, and the truth will prevail. I should not believe in God if I did not believe that. Mr. Higgins, I trust whatever else you have given up, you believe. Mr. Hale's voice dropped low in reverence. You believe in him. Nicholas Higgins suddenly stood straight stiff up. Margaret started to her feet, for she thought by the working of his face he was going into convulsions. Mr. Hale looked at her dismayed. At last Higgins found words. "Man, I could fell you to the ground for tempting me. What in business have you to try me wi' your doubts? Think of her lying there, after the life who's led, and think then how you'd deny me the one sole comfort left, that there is a God, and that he set her her life. I dunno believe she'll ever live again," said he, sitting down and drearily going on, as if to the unsympathizing fire. "I do not believe in any other life than this, in which she dreed such trouble, and had such never-ending care, and I cannot bear to think it were all a set of chances that might have been altered with a breath of wind. There's many a time when I've thought I didna believe in God, but I've never put it fair out before me in words, as many men do. I may have laughed at those who did, to brave it out like, but I have looked round at after to see if he heard me, if so be there was a he. But today, when I'm left desolate, I wanna listen to you wi' your questions and your doubts. There's but one thing steady and quiet in all this reeling world, and reason or no reason I'll cling to that. It's all very well for happy folk." Margaret touched his arm very softly. She had not spoken before, nor had he heard her rise. "Nicholas, we do not want to reason. You misunderstand my father. We do not reason. We believe, and so do you. It is the one sole comfort in such times." He turned round and caught her hand. "Aye, it is, it is." Brushing away the tears with the back of his hand. "But you know, she's lying dead at home, and I'm welly dazed with sorrow, and at times I hardly know what I'm saying. It's as if speeches folk have made, clever and smart things as I've thought at the time, come up now my heart's welly brossen. The strike's failed as well, don't you know that, miss? I were coming warm to ask her, like a beggar as I am, for a bit of comfort i' that trouble,
and I were knocked down by one who told me she were dead. Just dead. That were all, but that were enough for me."
Mr. Hale blew his nose and got up to snuff the candles in order to conceal his emotion.
"He's not an infidel, Margaret. How could you say so?" muttered he reproachfully. "I've a good mind to read him the 14th chapter of Job."
"Not yet, Papa, I think. Perhaps not at all. Let us ask him about the strike, and give him all the sympathy he needs and hopes to have from poor Bessie."
So they questioned and listened. The workman's calculations were based, like too many of the master's, on false premises. They reckoned on their fellow men as if they possessed the calculable powers of machines, no more, no less. No allowance for human passions getting the better of reason, as in the case of Boucher and the rioters, and believing that the representations of their injuries would have the same effect on strangers far away as the injuries, fancied or real, had upon themselves. They were consequently surprised and indignant at the poor Irish who had allowed themselves to be imported and brought over to take their places. This indignation was tempered, in some degree, by contempt for them Irishers, and by pleasure at the idea of the bungling way in which they would set to work and perplex their new masters with their ignorance and stupidity, strange exaggerated stories of which were already spreading through the town. But the most cruel cut of all was that of the Milton workman, who had defied and disobeyed the commands of the Union to keep the peace, whatever came, who had originated discord in the camp and spread the panic of the law being arrayed against them. "And so the strike is at an end," said Margaret.
"Aye, miss, it's save as save can. The factory doors will need open wide tomorrow to let in all who'll be axing for work, if it's only just to show they'd naught to do wi' a measure which, if we'd been made o' the right stuff, would have brought wages up to a point they'd not been at this 10 year.
"You'll get work, shan't you?" asked Margaret. "You're a famous workman, are not you?"
"Hamper'll let me work at his mill when he cuts off his right hand, not before and not after," said Nicholas quietly. Margaret was silenced and sad.
"About the wages," said Mr. Hale, "you'll not be offended, but I think you make some sad mistakes. I should like to read you some remarks in a book I have."
He got up and went to his bookshelves.
"You needn't trouble yourself, sir," said Nicholas. "Their book stuff goes in one ear and out at t'other. I can make naught on't. Afore Hamper and me had this split, the overlooker telled him I was stirring up the men to ask for higher wages, and Hamper met me one day in the yard. He'd a thin book in his hand, and says he, 'Higgins, I'm told you're one of those damned fools that think you can get higher wages for asking for 'em. Aye, and keep 'em up too, when you've forced 'em up. Now I'll give you a chance and try if you've any sense in you. Here's a book written by a friend of mine, and if you'll read it, you'll see how wages find their own level, without either masters or men having aught to do with them, except the men cut their own throats with striking, like the confounded noodles they are.'
Well now, sir, I'll put it to you, being a parson, and having been in the preaching line, and having had to try and bring folk o'er to what you thought was a right way of thinking. Did you begin by calling 'em fools and such like, or didn't you rather give 'em some kind words at first, to make 'em ready for to listen and be convinced, if they could? And in your preaching, did you stop every now and then and say, half to them and half to yourself, 'But you're such a pack of fools, but I've a strong notion it's no use my trying to put sense in you.' I were not in the best state, I'll own, for taking in what Hamper's friend had to say. I was so vexed at the way it were put to me. But I thought, 'Come, I'll see what these chaps has got to say, and try if it's them or me as is the noodle.' So I took the book and tugged at it. But Lord bless you, it went on about capital and labour and capital, till it fair sent me off to sleep. I ne'er could rightly fix in my mind which was which, and it spoke on 'em as if they was virtues or vices, and what I wanted for to know were the rights of men, whether they were rich or poor, so be they only were men. But for all that," said Mr. Hale,
and granting to the full the offensiveness, the folly, the unchristianness of Mr. Hamper's way of speaking to you in recommending his friend's book. Yet if it told you what he said it did, that wages find their own level, and that the most successful strike can only force them up for a moment, to sink in far greater proportion afterwards, in consequence of that very strike, the book would have told you the truth. "Well, sir," said Higgins rather doggedly, "it might, or it might not. There's two opinions go to settling that point. But suppose it was truth double strong." "It were no truth to me if I couldna take it in. I dare say there's truth in yon Latin book on your shelves, but it's gibberish and not truth to me, unless I know the meaning of the words. If you, sir, or any other knowledgeable, patient man come to me and says he'll larn me what the words mean and not blow me up if I'm a bit stupid or forget how one thing hangs on another, why, in time I may get to see the truth of it, or I may not. I'll not be bound to say I shall end in thinking the same as any man, and I'm not one who think truth can be shaped out in words all neat and clean, as the men at the foundry cut out sheet iron. Same bones won't go down with everyone. It'll stick here in this man's throat and there in t'others. Let alone that, when down, it may be too strong for this one, too weak for that. Folk who sets up to doctor the word with their truth mun suit different for different minds, and be a bit tender in the way of giving it too, or the poor sick fools may spit it out i' their faces. Now Hamper first gears me a box on my ear, and then he throws his big bolus at me, and says he reckons it'll do me no good, I'm such a fool, but there it is. I wish some of the kindest and wisest of the masters would meet some of you men and have a good talk on these things. It would surely be the best way of getting over your difficulties, which I do believe arise from your ignorance, excuse me, Mr. Higgins, on subjects which it is for the mutual interest of both masters and men should be well understood by both. I wonder, after his daughter, if Mr. Thornton might not be induced to do such a thing. "Remember, Papa," said she in a very low voice, "what he said one day, about governments, you know." She was unwilling to make any clearer allusion to the conversation they had held on the mode of governing workpeople. By giving men intelligence enough to rule themselves, or by a wise despotism on the part of the master, for she saw that Higgins had caught Mr. Thornton's name, if not the whole of the speech. Indeed, he began to speak of him.
"Thornton, he's the chap as wrote off at once for these Irishes, and led to the riot that ruined the strike. Even Hamper, wi' all his bullying, would have waited a while. But it's a word and a blow wi' Thornton. And now when the Union would have thanked him for following up the chase after Boucher, and them chaps as went right again our commands, it's Thornton who steps forward and coolly says that as the strike's at an end, he, as party injured, doesn't want to press the charge against the rioters. I thought he'd had more pluck. I thought he'd have carried his point, and had his revenge in an open way. But says he, one in court telled me his very words, they are well known. They will find the natural punishment of their conduct in the difficulty they will meet wi' in getting employment. That will be severe enough. I only wish they'd cotched Boucher and had him up before Hamper. I see the owd tiger setting on him. Would he ha' let him off? Not he."
"Mr. Thornton was right," said Margaret. "You are angry against Boucher, Nicholas, or else you would be the first to see that where the natural punishment would be severe enough for the offence, any farther punishment would be something like revenge."
"My daughter is no great friend of Mr. Thornton," said Mr. Hale, smiling at Margaret,
while she, as red as any carnation, began to work with double diligence.
"But I believe what she says is the truth. I like him for it." "Well, sir, this strike has been a weary piece of business to me, and you'll not wonder if I'm a bit put out wi' seeing it fail, just for a few men who wouldna suffer in silence and howd out brave and firm."
"You forget," said Margaret, "I don't know much of Boucher, but the only time I saw him it was not his own sufferings he spoke of, but those of his sick wife, his little children."
"True, but he were not made of iron himself. He'd have cried out for his own sorrows next. He were not one to bear."
"How came he into the Union?" asked Margaret innocently. "You don't seem to have much respect for him, nor gained much good from having him in." Higgins's brow clouded. He was silent for a minute or two. Then he said, shortly enough, "It's not for me to speak of the Union. What they does, they does. Them that is of a trade mun hang together, and if they're not willing to take their chance along with the rest, the Union has ways and means." Mr. Hale saw that Higgins was vexed at the turn the conversation had taken, and was silent. Not so Margaret, though she saw Higgins's feelings as clearly as he did. By instinct she felt that if he could be brought to express himself in plain words, something clear would be gained on which to argue for the right and the just. "And what are the Union's ways and means?" He looked up at her, as if on the point of dogged resistance to her wish for information, but her calm face, fixed on his, patient and trustful, compelled him to answer.
"Well, if a man doesn't belong to the Union, them as works next looms has orders not to speak to him. If he's sorry or ill, it's our the same. He's out of bounds. He's none of us. He comes among us. He works among us. But he's none of us. In some places, them's fine who speaks to him. You try that, miss. Try living a year or two among them as looks away if you look at 'em. Try working within 2 yards of crowds of men who you know have a grinding grudge at you in their hearts, to whom if you say you're glad, not an eye brightens nor a lip moves, to whom if your heart's heavy, you can never say nought, because they'll ne'er take notice on your sighs or sad looks, and a man's no man who'll groan out loud about folk asking him what's the matter. Just you try that, miss. 10 hours for 300 days, and you'll know a bit what the Union is."
"Why," said Margaret, "what tyranny this is. Nay, Higgins, I don't care one straw for your anger. I know you can't be angry with me if you would. And I must tell you the truth, that I never read in all the history I have read of a more slow lingering torture than this. And you belong to the Union, and you talk of the tyranny of the masters."
"Nay," said Higgins, "you may say what you like. The dead stand between you and every angry word of mine. Do you think I forget who's lying there, and how who loved you? And it's the masters as has made us sin, if the Union is a sin. Not this generation, maybe, but their fathers. Their fathers ground our fathers to the very dust, ground us to powder. Parson, I reckon I've heard my mother read out a text. The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. It's so with them. In those days of sore oppression, the Union began. It were a necessity. It's a necessity now, according to me. It's a withstanding of injustice, past, present, or to come. It may be like war. Along with it come crimes. But I think it were a greater crime to let it alone. Our only chance is binding men together in one common interest. And if some are cowards and some are fools, they mun come along and join the great march, whose only strength is in numbers."
"Oh," said Mr. Hale, sighing, "your Union in itself would be beautiful, glorious. It would be Christianity itself, if it were but for an end which affected the good of all, instead of that of merely one class as opposed to another."
"I reckon it's time for me to be going, sir," said Higgins, as the clock struck 10.
"Home," said Margaret very softly. He understood her and took her offered hand.
"Home, miss. You may trust me, though I am one of the Union."
"I do trust you most thoroughly, Nicholas."
"Stay," said Mr. Hale, hurrying to the bookshelves. "Mr. Higgins, I'm sure you'll join us in family prayer."
Higgins looked at Margaret doubtfully. Her grave, sweet eyes met his. There was no compulsion, only deep interest in them. He did not speak, but he kept his place. Margaret, the churchwoman, her father, the dissenter, Higgins, the infidel, knelt down together. It did them no harm. Chapter 29 A Ray of Sunshine. Some wishes crossed my mind and dimly cheered it, and one or two poor melancholy pleasures, each in the pale unwarming light of hope, silvering its flimsy wing, flew silent by, moths in the moonbeam. Coleridge. The next morning brought Margaret a letter from Edith. It was affectionate and inconsequent, like the writer. but the affection was charming to Margaret's own affectionate nature, and she had grown up with the inconsequence, so she did not perceive it. It was as follows.
"Oh, Margaret, it is worth a journey from England to see my boy. He is a superb little fellow, especially in his caps, and most especially in the one you sent him, you good, dainty-fingered, persevering little lady. Having made all the mothers here envious, I want to show him to somebody new and hear a fresh set of admiring expressions. Perhaps that's all the reason. Perhaps it is not. Nay, possibly, there is just a little cousinly love mixed with it. But I do want you so much to come here, Margaret. I'm sure it would be the very best thing for Aunt Hale's health. Everybody here is young and well, and our skies are always blue, and our sun always shines, and the band plays deliciously from morning till night. And to come back to the burden of my ditty, my baby always smiles. I am constantly wanting you to draw him for me, Margaret. It does not signify what he is doing. That very thing is prettiest, gracefulest, best. I think I love him a great deal better than my husband, who is getting stout and grumpy. What he calls busy. No, he is not. He has just come in with news of such a charming picnic given by the officers of the Hazard at anchor in the bay below. Because he has brought in such a pleasant piece of news, I retract all I said just now. Did not somebody burn his hand for having said or done something he was sorry for? Well, I can't burn mine, because it would hurt me, and the scar would be ugly. But I'll retract all I said as fast as I can. Cosmo is quite as great a darling as baby, and not a bit stout, and as ungrumpy as ever husband was. Only sometimes he is very, very busy. I may say that without Les' wifely duty. Where was I? I had something very particular to say. I know, once. Oh, it is this. Dearest Margaret, you must come and see me. It would do Aunt Hale good, as I said before. Get the doctor to order it for her. Tell him that it's the smoke of Milton that does her harm. I have no doubt it is that, really. 3 months, you must not come for less of this delicious climate. All sunshine and grapes as common as blackberries would quite cure her. I don't ask my uncle. Here the letter became more constrained and better written. Mr. Hale was in the corner, like a naughty child, for having given up his living. Because I dare say he disapproves of war and soldiers and bands of music. At least I know that many dissenters are members of the Peace Society, and I am afraid he would not like to come. But if he would, dear, pray say that Cosmo and I will do our best to make him happy, and I'll hide up Cosmo's red coat and sword and make the band play all sorts of grave, solemn things. Or if they do play Pomps and Vanities, it shall be in double slow time. Dear Margaret, if he would like to accompany you and Aunt Hale, we will try and make it pleasant, though I'm rather afraid of anyone who has done something for conscience' sake. You never did, I hope. Tell Aunt Hale not to bring many warm clothes, though I'm afraid it will be late in the year before you can come. But you have no idea of the heat here. I tried to wear my great beauty Indian shawl at a picnic. I kept myself up with proverbs as long as I could. Pride must abide, and such wholesome pieces of pith. But it was of no use. I was like Mama's little dog, tiny, with an elephant's trappings on, smothered, hidden, killed with my finery. So I made it into a capital carpet for us all to sit down upon. Here's this boy of mine, Margaret. If you don't pack up your things as soon as you get this letter and come straight off to see him, I shall think you're descended from King Herod. Margaret did long for a day of Edith's life, her freedom from care, her cheerful home, her sunny skies. If a wish could have transported her, she would have gone off, just for one day. She yearned for the strength which such a change would give, even for a few hours, to be in the midst of that bright life and to feel young again. Not yet 20, and she had had to bear up against such hard pressure that she felt quite old. That was her first feeling after reading Edith's letter. Then she read it again, and, forgetting herself, was amused at its likeness to Edith's self, and was laughing merrily over it when Mrs. Hale came into the drawing-room, leaning on Dixon's arm. Margaret flew to adjust the pillows. Her mother seemed more than usually feeble. "What were you laughing at, Margaret?"
asked she, as soon as she had recovered from the exertion of settling herself on the sofa.
A letter I have had this morning from Edith. Shall I read it to you, Mama?
She read it aloud, and for a time it seemed to interest her mother, who kept wondering what name Edith had given to her boy, and suggesting all probable names and all possible reasons why each and all of these names should be given. Into the very midst of these wonders, Mr. Thornton came, bringing another offering of fruit for Mrs. Hale. He could not, say rather, he would not, deny himself the chance of the pleasure of seeing Margaret. He had no end in this, but the present gratification. It was the sturdy willfulness of a man usually most reasonable and self-controlled. He entered the room, taking in at a glance the fact of Margaret's presence. But after the first cold, distant bow, he never seemed to let his eyes fall on her again. He only stayed to present his peaches, to speak some gentle, kindly words, and then his cold, offended eyes met Margaret's with a grave farewell as he left the room. She sat down, silent and pale.
"Do you know, Margaret, I really begin quite to like Mr. Thornton."
No answer at first. Then Margaret forced out an icy, "Do you?"
"Yes, I think he is really getting quite polished in his manners."
Margaret's voice was more in order now. She replied, "He is very kind and attentive. There is no doubt of that."
"I wonder Mrs. Thornton never calls. She must know I am ill, because of the waterbed.
I dare say she hears how you are from her son.
Still, I should like to see her. You have so few friends here, Margaret."
Margaret felt what was in her mother's thoughts, a tender craving to bespeak the kindness of some woman towards the daughter that might be so soon left motherless, but she could not speak.
"Do you think," said Mrs. Hale after a pause, "that you could go and ask Mrs. Thornton to come and see me? Only once. I don't want to be troublesome."
"I will do anything if you wish it, Mama. But when Frederick comes..."
"Ah, to be sure. We must keep our doors shut. We must let no one in. I hardly know whether I dare wish him to come or not. Sometimes I think I would rather not. Sometimes I have such frightful dreams about him."
"Oh, Mama, we'll take good care. I will put my arm in the bolt sooner than he should come to the slightest harm. Trust the care of him to me, Mama. I will watch over him like a lioness over her young."
"When can we hear from him?"
"Not for a week yet, certainly. Perhaps more."
"We must send Martha away in good time. It would never do to have her here when he comes, and then send her off in a hurry."
"Dixon is sure to remind us of that. I was thinking that if we wanted any help in the house while he is here, we could perhaps get Mary Higgins. She is very slack of work, and is a good girl, and would take pains to do her best, I am sure, and would sleep at home, and need never come upstairs, so as to know who is in the house."
"As you please, as Dixon pleases. But, Margaret, don't get used to these horrid Milton words. Slack of work. It is a provincialism. What will your Aunt Shaw say if she hears you use it on her return?"
"Oh, Mama, don't try and make a bugbear of Aunt Shaw," said Margaret, laughing. "Edith picked up all sorts of military slang from Captain Lennox, and Aunt Shaw never took any notice of it."
"But yours is factory slang."
"And if I live in a factory town, I must speak factory language when I want it. Why, Mama, I could astonish you with a great many words you never heard in your life. I don't believe you know what a knobstick is."
"Not I, child. I only know it has a very vulgar sound, and I don't want to hear you using it."
"Very well, dearest mother, I won't. Only I shall have to use a whole explanatory sentence instead."
"I don't like this, Milton," said Mrs. Hale. "Edith is right enough in saying it's the smoke that has made me so ill."
Margaret started up as her mother said this. Her father had just entered the room, and she was most anxious that the faint impression she had seen on his mind, that the Milton air had injured her mother's health, should not be deepened, should not receive any confirmation. She could not tell whether he had heard what Mrs. Hale had said or not, but she began speaking hurriedly of other things, unaware that Mr. Thornton was following him.
"Mama is accusing me of having picked up a great deal of vulgarity since we came to Milton."
The vulgarity Margaret spoke of referred purely to the use of local words, and the expression arose out of the conversation they had just been holding. But Mr. Thornton's brow darkened, and Margaret suddenly felt how her speech might be misunderstood by him. So in the natural sweet desire to avoid giving unnecessary pain, she forced herself to go forwards with a little greeting and continue what she was saying, addressing herself to him expressly. "Now, Mr. Thornton, though knobstick has not a very pretty sound, is it not expressive? Could I do without it in speaking of the thing it represents? If using local words is vulgar, I was very vulgar in the forest, was I not, Mama?" It was unusual with Margaret to obtrude her own subject of conversation on others, but in this case she was so anxious to prevent Mr. Thornton from feeling annoyance at the words he had accidentally overheard that it was not until she had done speaking that she coloured all over with consciousness, more especially as Mr. Thornton seemed hardly to understand the exact gist or bearing of what she was saying, but passed her by with a cold reserve of ceremonious movement to speak to Mrs. Hale. The sight of him reminded her of the wish to see his mother and commend Margaret to her care. Margaret, sitting in burning silence, vexed and ashamed of her difficulty in keeping her right place and her calm unconsciousness of heart when Mr. Thornton was by, heard her mother's slow entreaty that Mrs. Thornton would come and see her soon, tomorrow, if it were possible. Mr. Thornton promised that she should, conversed a little, and then took his leave, and Margaret's movements and voice seemed at once released from some invisible chains. He never looked at her, and yet the careful avoidance of his eyes betokened that in some way he knew exactly where, if they fell by chance, they would rest on her. If she spoke, he gave no sign of attention, and yet his next speech to anyone else was modified by what she had said. Sometimes there was an express answer to what she had remarked, but given to another person, as though unsuggested by her. It was not the bad manners of ignorance, it was the willful bad manners arising from deep offence. It was willful at the time, repented of afterwards. But no deep plan, no careful cunning could have stood him in such good stead. Margaret thought about him more than she had ever done before, not with any tinge of what is called love, but with regret that she had wounded him so deeply, and with a gentle, patient striving to return to their former position of antagonistic friendship. For a friend's position was what she found that he had held in her regard, as well as in that of the rest of the family. There was a pretty humility in her behaviour to him, as if mutely apologising for the overstrong words which were the reaction from the deeds of the day of the riot. But he resented those words bitterly. They rung in his ears, and he was proud of the sense of justice which made him go on in every kindness he could offer to her parents. He exulted in the power he showed in compelling himself to face her whenever he could think of any action which might give her father or mother pleasure. He thought that he disliked seeing one who had mortified him so keenly, but he was mistaken. It was a stinging pleasure to be in the room with her and feel her presence, but he was no great analyzer of his own motives and was mistaken, as I have said. Chapter 30. Home at Last. The saddest birds a season find to sing. Southwell. Never to fold the robe o'er secret pain, never, weighed down by memory's clouds again, to bow thy head, thou art gone home. Mrs. Hemans. Mrs. Thornton came to see Mrs. Hale the next morning. She was much worse. One of those sudden changes, those great visible strides towards death, had been taken in the night, and her own family were startled by the grey, sunken look her features had assumed in that 1 12 hours of suffering. Mrs. Thornton, who had not seen her for weeks, was softened all at once. She had come because her son asked it from her as a personal favour, but with all the proud, bitter feelings of her nature in arms against that family of which Margaret formed one. She doubted the reality of Mrs. Hale's illness. She doubted any want beyond a momentary fancy on that lady's part, which should take her out of her previously settled course of employment for the day. She told her son that she wished they had never come near the place, that he had never got acquainted with them, that there had been no such useless languages as Latin and Greek ever invented. He bore all this pretty silently, but when she had ended her invective against the dead languages, he quietly returned to the short curtain.